What's up, guys? It's your boy Nick Hill, and we're back for another episode of Into the Muse. Today I have Matt Gardner in the Muse.
What's interesting about Matt is that he's in a band called Ground Level Falcons, and their latest EP, Skyline, each song in this EP represents the seven stages of recovery.
So Matt, being a band, I'm sure there's like a lot of individuals in the group, and coming up with this story, like, what was the idea behind it, and why did you guys decide to tell this specific story?
Yeah, no, good question, for sure. So I guess basically what happens with our whole songwriting process is, and it's always how it's worked. Like, I think our 10-year anniversary is actually, like, pretty much right, almost down to the month, like, right away here. So,
oh, congratulations.
Yeah, man, thanks. So basically how it's always been for us is like, I do the songwriting and, you know, the structure, the original arrangements and just the stories behind the songs. I'll usually actually just go out to like a cabin or something where it's not nearly as distracting and just kind of get out of town and just have this like outpouring of writing and such. And then I'll bring it back to the guys, have some acoustic demos basically to show them. And then I'm super open to collaboration, right? Like, I'm not a control freak as far as, oh, it's got to be this way. This is how I wrote it. So it's got, you know, so I'm pretty open to, I much prefer, you know, collaboration at the end of the day, right? And I think you get more of a buy-in with the guys when they can, you know, kind of champion the parts that they came up with too. So it just works out better for everybody. But so as far as the story, yeah, like I come up with the stories. How I come up with them, I don't know, man. I think it's this kind of, you got to be open to, I'm just kind of open to kind of whatever hits me. Like, it's I know you're like, I like the name of your podcast, right? Enter the Muse. Like, I kind of have, I guess, a muse, right? Like, I just I have a certain, so I think everybody,
yeah, I feel every song. Artist does, they have the connection, right, to the, right, muse.
Totally, dude. I was really drawn to your podcast right away. I just saw the name, I'm like, man, I gotta get a hold of this guy because it was such a cool name. So kudos to you for the name.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
I guess the Muse inspired me to choose that name.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, totally. So that's kind of how it is, man. Like, I think everybody's kind of got like their own story to tell. I try and get out of the way of it, right? So if something, for me, I like Nick, I just try and combine as much stuff as currently is happening in my life as elements. So then at least I have some kind of reference point. So then it kind of comes off more real or genuine. But then I also throw a little bit of, like, a twist of fiction on it too, right? Because when I was first writing songs, you know, in my early 20s, chances are they came off very much like journal entries, right? Like, they were a little too on the nose, a little too personal, almost embarrassing to present. So I purposefully kind of have a bit of a filter of fiction sort of twisted in there. But by the same token, a lot of the experiences are, you know, things that I've actually gone through as well. So, you know, and everybody can kind of relate to this one is I think universally relatable as far as, you know, everybody's gone through a breakup and everybody has felt these different stages that they've had to get through to get to the other side. And, you know, and I just like the combination of, like, I always use like nature as, you know, because I think that's a strong part of my tapping into my creativity. I have my most creative moments when I'm out walking in
so
nature.
So do you write music when you're like out in nature or in a hike, or do you like gather inspiration and then you go back and then write about it later on?
Yeah, man. No, good. You got good questions. So a little bit of both. So if I'm out camping, I always got a notebook with me now. And honestly, you know, technology makes it pretty easy to, you know, do voice memos, like just kind of even hum something that comes to me. So a little bit of both, I guess. I like to be open to anything, kind of whenever it hits me. Having said that, though, there is something to be said for doing a walk out in nature without anything and just and then bringing back your findings, so to speak, and then trying to scribble it down before you forget it, right? It's like waking up and then you have this crazy dream and you want to write it down, but 10 minutes later you completely forget what it is, right? So that kind of situation.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that your band members, you guys just gel, you guys have a good basis of communication and things. I feel that's like really important in bands, because like I've noticed that in almost every band, there's always a breakup. Like, you look at the Beatles, Rolling Stones, every single band. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, man, dude, you bring the wood. You got some good questions. So I, you know, I think a lot of it, a lot of times, like, are you in a band yourself, or kind of what's your?
No, I'm a musician.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I'm sure you've had you know, elements of this where if you're collaborating with somebody, there can, you know, egos can kind of get involved from time to time, right? Everybody's, you know, I always view it as when you're being a creative person, you're kind of putting yourself out there. So there's a degree of vulnerability. So if somebody, and it's all about the presentation, right? It's all about mutual respect. So if somebody takes a dump on your idea, right? And you just kind of course you're going to maybe take it personally, right? So your ego might kind of come up and go, well, and then all of a sudden it comes this point of contention or competitiveness. So I've been in bands before that I didn't really care for the vibe. It almost had this like sport vibe to it. The guys that I was in the band with, it was almost like competitive. And I don't work well with that. I know some people love the, you know, the little bit of friendly competition, or, you know, when it edges, you know what I mean? Where it almost edges into like actual competition, where honestly, man, there's no real spot for it, in my opinion, as far as, you know, that's, you go play sports, go play basketball. Then if you want to be like that, you should be trying to work together and harmonious. So for us, I can speak for us, but I can also, like, when you're asking about bands breaking up, I would say dollars to donuts, man, like 98% of the time, it's because egos, they can't, it turns into a pissing contest. One person thinks they got better ideas. You know, I've been in bands like that, but this band is definitely not like that. Like I say, 10 years, I've been with Brendan, the drummer, for 15 years. So we were in a band before this band. So, you know, you don't get into, you know, that longevity of a time but I do want to backtrack, because again, good question, man. There's a little bit to unpack here for sure. So for us now, I turned 40. Brendan's the youngster of the group. He's, I want to say 34. Greg is the clan elder. He's the bass player. He's, I want to say 43. So you know what, like when you kind of get to this, our ages now, like there's families involved, like they got some little ones at home. We try and make the best of our time together. Right. So it's kind of gotten to the stage where the expectations have lowered a bit, but they're still healthy, if that makes sense. Like we know when we come together, we can make the most of our time. And the fact that we have 10 years worth of equity as a band, we can get the most out of a couple hours a week, if that's all that it ends up being, versus back in the day, when we were first starting, of course, like when you are trying to figure each other's styles out and how they all fit together, we were practicing 3, 4, 5 times a week. We were playing, you know, 3 or 4 shows a month, if not more, right? So we were really into it. So I think all that extra work that we did in the early on stages, like the first 2 or 3 years of the band, has really paid dividends for us too. That's kind of been our longevity now, because we can come back together even after a couple of weeks. And, you know, with COVID and everything that happened, there were a couple of months that we wouldn't be practicing. So of course, you know, you kind of come back and there's a little bit of rust to knock off just because you haven't been playing together. So the first 5-10 minutes sound a little bit ugly because you're not used to it. Right. Yeah. And then after you get through that part, it's just like, man, it's like anything else. It's like riding a bike. You get back up there and we're always surprised. We're like, holy crap, this is actually sounding pretty good considering we haven't played in 2 months. Right. So that's it. I think that's the key to our longevity and why we haven't had any rifts that way. We've had a lot of lineup changes along the way, guys have, but I guess the de facto band leader, I've never accepted anybody's outright quitting. I always say, you know what, you can take a leave of absence, but you know, all roads point you coming back to the band. And that's kind of part of the story of this album too. There was a couple of the members came back after a lengthy period of time off.
Would you say that the place that you guys are as a band right now, what's your goals or with this EP and things, or like where do you see your place as a band at this moment?
So right now with this, honestly, we were just happy to get it out because it was a little bit of a haul to get this one done. And it was, I kind of alluded to it earlier with the whole COVID, you know, pandemic situation. There was actually a chunk of time kind of right in the middle of getting ready to record these songs where there was a big lockdown in like our city that we're from, in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada up here. So there was probably about 3 or 4 months that we literally didn't play at all. So it was, and that was like right in the kind of right when the songs are getting refined and practiced to the point that they are ready to record and start playing shows and, you know, playing live. Right. So they were right at that stage and it's almost like you kind of get kicked in the yam bag and, you know, like the legs are cut out from under you. So that was a little bit tricky. And then to come back 4 months later and kind of try to recapture that magic that we had sort of at the inception of it. Like, that's always the funnest time, right? Is when you first write a song, and you know, that's always the funnest. I'm sure, I'm not how it is for you, but like, it definitely is for us. It's like, it's
yeah, kind I love writing. Right? Sorry to cut you there. Yeah. But I was just going to say, like, the writing process is definitely, or what I found for myself recently is going there with beats and just like getting it done, almost like freestyling, like just like letting the beat like hit you. I know for bands it's different because when you guys orchestrate, like come up with a piece, I know like in bands, the way you guys do it is like, you guys like come up with it together on the spot. Or what's your process as Ground Level Falcons when it comes to composing and coming up with all of your music?
So yeah, a little bit of both. Like we have the flexibility of, okay, so yeah, we have kind of two schools of thought. So as I mentioned before, I'll bring, you know, the kind of the first draft versions of the songs to the rehearsals. But having said that, we intentionally make sure that we have kind of to your point, like some improv areas in between the songs. So we always make sure, and we sometimes that's captured on the album, sometimes not, because it comes off a little self-indulgent if you had that. Funny mention, actually, we ended up doing a full album of what we called interludes, which are the improv songs that we had in between the songs when we played them live. So because we didn't want the album to be like, you know, 120 minutes or whatnot. So we did a whole second album of like the improv jam sessions that we would have in between the songs. So that's definitely a big part of it for us as well, because to me, honestly, dude, that's like the funnest for me is doing the jamming and kind of what you're talking about. You know, the beat starts and you're like, okay, and then you just react to it. And then you often will come up with something that you would normally never be able to write because you're reacting. You're in the
moment. Yeah, it takes you into like a different place almost.
It does. It totally does. And I love that, man. So we were kind of missing that a little bit because we were so down the rabbit hole of writing songs and then practicing them and then more practice and more practice. And that's great. Don't get me wrong. There's a place for that because, you know, for obvious reasons, you want to show up to a gig and perform and have these tight songs, because that's kind of the currency that you deal with as a band. But having said that, I like having, and I think it's kind of rock and roll. It's kind of that reckless feeling that anything can happen, where you're kind of doing, you're going out there on a limb, and you know, it takes some courage, because sometimes it can sound not so good. Sometimes it sounds amazing, and people can kind of tell, the audience can tell there's something unique. And when you're starting to do improv, they can tell it's like, it's still part of the show, but they also know that it's not part of the song and you're kind of just winging it. So that part is tremendously fun for us. And that is actually my favorite part, is the improv in between, because by the time the songs are being performed in front of people, I'm almost already over them. I know that sounds bad, but the excitement for me has almost been drained out of the process of refining them to the point they sound really good to perform for people. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Because yesterday I was actually recording stuff like a few months ago. Like I was freestyling to this beat and it came off as like true and like raw. And I just felt that like there was like emotion to it when I was doing that. And then recently I bought the license for the beat. So that song was tagged. So I was gonna like, cause that was freestyling. And then I just like wrote a few stuff to add in, and I was gonna re-record it. And I was re-recording yesterday, and the delivery on some verses were better, but the feel of the original, the raw one was just, it just hit different, if you get what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, man, it's exactly just how you said it. It hits different. It completely does. Like there's something magical about that first time, right? That you can never recreate. You can never go back. And I mean, you can try, and like you say, maybe it'll technically sound better, or it'll be more, a little more on time, or this or that. But the way that it hit you, and the way that you're presenting it as a result, will never quite be the same as that first magical time where you almost get those goosebumps, right? And that kind of butterflies in your stomach, right? So totally know what you mean. I love that too, man.
So when it comes to your audience, like the fan bases, like right now, I'm sure when you started off 10 years ago, it was a bit different, but like now, like the market for grunge music, right here in South Africa, I don't know how it is in Canada, but like it's very small at the moment. Like mainstream pop or hip hop, that's what's like out there. I know, like, remember in the 2000s, rock was on every radio station, and now it's like a revolution. It's just hip hop, trap, rap, all of that kind of stuff. So
yeah, for sure.
Have you noticed like this change in your audience or your target market or whatever?
Another good question for sure. So I mean, there's a few things that go to that, right? I'm not overly concerned because, you know, and it has changed. I should say that, preface that, like it has definitely changed over time. But I'm not concerned about it because I think, you know, as well, like anything in art or in music or in film or anything, you know, it's a cyclical thing. So what's old is new again. So at some point, and we're just going to keep doing what we're doing. We're not trying to, yeah, you know what I mean? We're not trying to like bend into like more poppy music or anything. And I think there's always going to be an audience for grunge. And if you remember grunge, you know, before it blew up in the early 90s there, it was kind of a niche thing to begin with, like stoner rock and grunge. It was called alternative rock, but then it became mainstreams, right? So right. I am perfectly fine and I feel settled and we feel settled. I think I can, you know, safely speak on behalf of the rest of the band with that corner, that niche. In fact, I feel almost a little bit more comfortable that it isn't considered pop music. Like I don't know. I just, the people that we have as a fan base has kind of grown with us and they kind of grew up with the same music. But yeah, like, I mean, even if you look back 10 years ago, we were sending our music out to a lot of different spots in Europe. We've had some radio play down in South Africa as well. And, you know, I think 12 or 13 different countries. So, I mean, that shows there is still a market for rock. Yeah. Is it mainstream? I mean, maybe not right now, but will it be in 5-10 years? I mean, who knows, right? It's always seems to be the way it goes, right? Is you know, eventually what's old is new again. And there's always like peaks and valleys between, you know, genres of music. So I'm not overly concerned. In fact, I kind of like having it a little more tamed down and the people that like it really like it, right? Instead of, yeah. And then there's no pressure to have to sound like anybody or kind of fit in like with anybody. So I'm completely comfortable with the fact that it has kind of taken a back seat. And then, you know, as our, you know, the way I genre us is like alternative or grunge. And, you know, alternative actually sounds like it applies in this case because it is sort of, it is alternative.
Yeah. When you mentioned like, who knows, in 5 years time, maybe it could be mainstream. I was just wondering, yeah, like, what do you think drives pop culture in that way? Like, what is it, do you think, that determines what is popular music and what is not? Like, because fans will always be there. And especially like right now with social media, it, like YouTube targets you for your specific interests. So what do you think is the thing that actually like shifts the narrative in a way of what is pop and what is alternative?
So I think there's a few different things, as you know, as with everything, there's a few different things that make it up, right? The timing is everything. I mean, if you look back into, I would just go back to the genesis of the whole grunge, the initial grunge outburst would have been, you know, Nirvana, Nevermind, Smells Like Teen Spirit. And that seemingly came out of nowhere. And that knocked off everything that was considered pop at the time, right? That was like Michael Jackson, I think Garth Brooks, and all these like other, you know, hard, like heavyweight pop musicians. And this band out of nowhere, these seemingly unknown band from Seattle, took them all out. And then from there, you get all the fashion sense that came with it. And I think a lot of people, honestly, Nick, sort of buy into hype. I'm not calling anybody out for it necessarily, because, you know, if I think that's where a lot of things kind of get their legs and become pop culture. It's sort of that total package. It's the presentation. It's the need to, I guess, be a part of something that is, like you said the word revolution, something that feels like it's now, feels like it's really capturing the feeling of the world today, and is really kind of, you know what I mean? It's really like put its hand on the pulse of what's going on at the time, right? So, you know, again, back to the Nirvana thing, like people wanted something alternative to knock off all that kind of plasticky pop music that was coming out that was very repetitive at the time. And it was kind of, if you remember, I mean, the end of the 80s was very much a hair metal time, and people were kind of getting sick of that whole image, the mullets. I mean, come on, all that kind of stuff is like, you know. And then so then Nirvana came in, they're wearing plaid and again, they provided sort of an alternate narrative as far as, you know, what else was going on in the world. And then all of a sudden that started resonating with people. And then before you know it, everybody's wearing plaid and growing, you know, 3 or 4 days worth of beard. And instead of the mullets, they got the full like side shave, like the undercut or whatever it is. And, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think a lot of it you know, there's obviously influencers, people that say, hey, I champion this, I really like this. And then everybody that looks up to that influencer is like, I like that too. And before you know it, that's kind of like the movement sort of shifts that way. I think there's a little bit more of that now with obviously with social media. It was much more prominent, you know, than it was, you know, even 5-7 years ago. I mean, it's really a huge thing now. So I think it's kind of a bit about that. It's definitely a fascinating time to live in because it is a lot more to do with, you know, people, everybody's got a voice now. So there is a lot of, you know, people on social media that can influence that, you know, 5 years ago, they just would have been nobody's essentially, right? So it's definitely fascinating to kind of see how things can end up becoming pop culture today as opposed to how it was even 5 years ago, but especially, you know, 20-25 years ago, where it was newspapers, it was, you know, MTV, it was
like, because there's like so much potential of someone becoming an influencer, it actually makes it harder because people's attention spans, like a meme could be trending for like a week and then the next week it's dead. Like no one cares about it. Like it's shifting so quick that like in order, like even like great pieces of art, like, well, that's a different thing. But like, if you compare Drake's latest album to Kanye West's latest album, I found like Drake's is like more for like pop, like people. And then like Kanye's as an art piece, it's standalone as an art piece. It's just on its own thing, but like, and like, it's also your target audience, like people are gonna relate, but like because Kanye is such a big influencer already, people like generate towards that kind of music. And then if you like get like maybe, let's say Lil Pump or just someone like a random person on YouTube who like blew up, they're like, people will be like vibing to it like for a while, but then afterwards, like they are forgotten. Unless they do something that's like really great on its own.
Nice, Nick, you're very good point. Like it's I think you're right. I think everything's so divergent and people's attention spans being what they are. And there's so many like subgenres, more subgenres than there ever has been before. And I think people kind of like almost consume things so quickly. I'm kind of curious to see what you think about it as well. Before I got a question for you, but I just want to mention as well, because you kind of touched on it, is there so many different, I guess, influencers, there's so many different sort of routes that you can take. Like for us, we've always just been, I don't know, I remember reading this article, I don't know if you've seen this one, it's about like like 1,000 fans, basically. If you have 1,000 true fans, that is enough to generate, you know, a living off of, basically. So if you can find 1,000 people that really buy into what you're doing, you don't necessarily need to go the route of, oh, you know, getting like these Kanye numbers or whatever. I mean, obviously nowhere close to that, but you get what I mean, where you can you know, there's a lot more opportunity to go like with a little bit smaller of a scope as far as how many people you want to reach. And if you can get 1,000 true fans, it's an interesting article. Unfortunately, can't remember who wrote it, but if you haven't heard it or read about it, I would highly recommend that one.
Yeah, I'll Google it.
Yeah, dude, it's pretty interesting. And it kind of goes just hand in hand with what you were mentioning, which is a very good point. Oh man, I wish I wrote it down. I had a specific question that I wanted your take on. I'm sure it'll come back to me, but anyways. Yeah, interesting stuff though, because you're right. It's like, it's such a different time as far as like availability, as far as like worldwide availability, who might hear you. Oh man, it's just, it's like no other time.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. You mentioned Nirvana earlier and Kurt Cobain and how his influence, like what influence he had on like pop culture and mainstream at the time. And that was grunge. Like, do you think that Nirvana in a way inspired you or your band? And what influence did Nirvana actually have on you as a grunge musician?
Yeah, no, for sure. So Nirvana, basically that whole grunge scene is huge for me, because I would have been in my you know, like basically age 9 to 12. So, and for me before that, it was like, I'm not ashamed to admit, whatever, it was like Bon Jovi, Cinderella.
When you were like 9?
Yeah, when I was like 9. So, and then by the time I was like, you know, 10 or 11, and you're starting to get into Pearl Jam, and Pearl Jam's talking about Jeremy, which is about a school shooting. I was like, holy shit. Like, sorry for swearing. I don't know if I can swear.
No, it's cool.
I was like, you know, like, wow, this is what you can do with music. And the video is just so riveting. I know what you're asking about Kurt Cobain, so we'll get to him in a sec. But, and yeah, well, I guess there we go. Like, we'll get right into it. Smells Like Teen Spirit. The video was like nothing else I'd ever seen. And it was like, you know, very haunting and like poor lighting. And just as the way he was presented was, you know, really overexposed, getting really close to the camera. And it was just like, you could tell it was such a different way of presenting. So when you're at a young, easily influenced age that I was, man, did I, and you know, when you're growing up, you kind of go through the dark phases where you're kind of the brooding teenager and all that. So that was my soundtrack, like for my high school, right? Is Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains. Those are like the Mount Rushmore of grunge, as far as I'm concerned anyways. So, you know, really relating to, and dude, I love it because it's kind of a natural extension of like the 70s music. If you look at it, they do a lot of what you would call, you know, they're,
yeah, got like the rock. If you look at like the 90s as a period, they had a lot of 70s influence. It was almost like a repeat of the 70s and the 90s.
I would think the musicians would be perfectly fine with us saying that too. Like, you could tell they liked Zeppelin, you could tell they liked The Who, bands like that, right? And they have the kind of,
because wouldn't it have been like their parents' kind of music?
Exactly, absolutely. And even some of them might have grown up with it, same kind of thing too, right? Like, as far as 90s music was for me, you know, 70s music would have been for them. So I know Eddie Vedder, he grew up with The Who and he loves The Who, and like, so you can kind of, you can see that in his music. And you know, and The Who, man, I'd take The Who over Zeppelin any day. Just a personal preference there, but yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, like, you can tell, like, they have the acoustic music, like you know, both Nirvana and Pearl Jam. You can look at Daughter, basically a primarily acoustic song, Elderly Woman, acoustic song. But then on the same album, they have Go, they have Rearview Mirror. So they have the both sides of the coin, right? As well as you know, with Nirvana, they got Heart-Shaped Box, really really big rocking song. But then they got you know, Penny Royalty on the same album, right? So I've always liked that ability to kind of shape shift within the same album, which is kind of what we tried to do with all our albums as well. So yeah, for sure, as far as the 90s influence, huge, absolutely huge for us. We also like Neil Young a fair bit. Well, he's my favorite artist, I think, is Neil Young. I just like how prolific he's been. I mean, so many albums. He's got like 40 albums or something like that. And wow. And they're all different, right? He followed the trend sometimes just to kind of keep up with the Joneses. Like, he kind of went into some electronica to varying successes, but he's also known as the godfather of grunge. Like, he's the kind of the first guy that had that sort of, you know, slow, fuzzed out, kind of slow motion-y, kind of almost metal-y sound, right, to him. And also has got some beautiful acoustic music. So I like somebody that can kind of, you know, cover all elements of different types of genres and kind of shapeshift a bit, but still at the end of the day, sound like themselves. Like, there's some cohesion to what they're doing.
When you were mentioning Kurt Cobain's appeal, like, I feel like, because I wasn't like around during that time, but I feel like he has like the same appeal that James Dean did in cinema and things. Like, but like, and then again, like, his influence or appeal just like grew after he died. I feel like if he was still around today, people wouldn't look at him the same way. The same thing with like Tupac and Biggie. If they like,
for sure,
could like Diddy, he's still alive today. Axel of Guns N' Roses, he's still alive today. And like, they're not held to the same, they're not put on the same pedestal as the ones who passed away during that time.
Yeah. And you know what? It is, it's too bad. I mean, like you say, there's for the musicians you mentioned, like Slash, you know, there's always going to be appetite for destruction. But yeah, you're right. You're right. Like, the further along he gets, it's kind of like, he's kind of a weird guy, right? Like, he's kind of just, and yeah, like, it takes some of the wind out of the sails, and the legend kind of gets almost like sad to watch, like Ozzy Osbourne, right? It's kind of like, man, this guy's, this like 70-year-old man is still up there.
Yeah, and he's crazy. Like he's done like crazy stuff. Like people look at him as that. Well, his music is still good now. Ordinary Man. I don't know if you heard of that. If you heard it, it was like really good.
Is
Yeah, I think he was. Elton John was also on that song.
Right. Okay. I heard about all about this this album or these songs, but I haven't listened to him yet. But no, as far as like, you know, Tupac and all, of course, it adds and good comparison, like the James Dean thing. Of course, like it's like, man, it adds this whole, and we're talking about like layers and you know, different things that add to stories. It completely adds to the story. And there's like the whole 27 club too, right? So it's Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison, all these
Amy Winehouse.
Amy Winehouse, right? All these people that died at 27. So all of a sudden there's this like mystique. And you know how it is in rock and roll and music, for whatever reason, even in art in general, it almost has this like martyrdom attached to it, where it's like, I don't know. And they were, you know, they were too good to be, to remain with us. So there's like this legend that grows because of that. So, you know, it's a good point. I've often kind of wondered, you know, what Kurt Cobain would be doing. Would he be even making decent music, or would it be like really weird, you know, because he was
always fade into, what's that quote?
Yeah. Better to burn out than fade away.
Yeah.
Which is actually a Neil Young line. That's actually from right. Hey, Hey, My, My. Yeah. So, yeah, no, interesting to think though, for sure. I guess that was his story. I mean, it's unfortunate because, you know, obviously he was very, you know, inebriated at the time of writing that, and he was in a pretty rough spot. But, you know, and some other artists, you know, they think that they need these substances to tap into, you know, their muse, right? And we're talking about a lot about like artist habits, and there are a lot of artists over the years in all genres of art that get, you know, get inebriated with whether it's drugs or alcohol or both, in order to, in their mind, tap into their muse or be pure with their art. And I, you know, I think he was kind of one of those. And it's sad, like, you know, when you're growing up, again, like when I was kind of the brooding teenager, I could relate to that. And I wouldn't say looked up to him, but I was like, man, that's so poetic and it's so dark and all this. And now I'm just like, of course, you know, I yeah, it's just sad now. I don't feel that way at all now. But, you know, I think that's another reason why I kind of related. So many people related to that at the time, because he was like, you know, he was speaking for so many people that couldn't express themselves in a certain way. And then he kills himself. Like, that's pretty heavy duty, man.
Yeah. If you look at him and you look at James Dean, like the way they are regarded now, it's almost as if they're like a character from like a Tarantino movie, like one of like Brad Pitt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like,
yeah,
they like, you like, it's like almost as if they couldn't exist, but they did.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's funny you mentioned that one, that whole controversial scene where the Brad Pitt character beats up the Bruce Lee character.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Man, oh man. That was rough to watch too. I'm like, oh, I don't know.
Are you a Bruce Lee fan?
Oh, of course. Of course. How about you?
Yeah. I like his stuff. Like, and he was very smart. He was like philosophical and things. He's another person who died too young. Like, there's that whole thing that he was killed.
Murdered.
Yeah. It could have been the Chinese, or the triads, or
which is
who knows? Because that guy, he was as fit as anyone could be. Like, he was like at peak human condition. And he just suddenly dies from a brain aneurysm or something to do with, like, I'm not sure what's the actual cause of his death, but it had something to do with his brain.
Yeah, which seems pretty strange. Like you say, literally as peak physical condition as a person can be, for sure. And then sad with his son too, right? His son dies on like a movie set.
Yeah.
You know, years later, and kind of has a bit of a legend to him too because of the Crow movie, right? But
yeah, and then like they said like it's a part of like it was a curse on his family, like people believe that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Yeah, the whole Bruce Lee and yeah, that family, you're right. It's but yeah, I know it definitely ruffled some feathers, the whole the Brad Pitt character beating the crap out of the Bruce Lee character. I know the Lee family was pretty upset with Tarantino for that, which is pretty humorous.
Yeah, and I love Tarantino's response. Like, he just doesn't give a fuck.
No, man. I don't know. What do you think about Tarantino, though, now? Like, he had this interview on Joe Rogan podcast, and he kind of came off a little bit strange. Like, he's definitely kind of, it was almost like sort of one of those don't beat your heroes moments. Like, he just came off a little bit.
Yeah, I know, but he's a weird guy. Like, he's strange. He like, he has a foot fetish. Like, in all his movies, he always has to show women's feet. And
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, but that's also like contributes to his like movies. Like, if you look at him, like, his movies are like so cool, like the characters and stuff, but he's like probably like the uncoolest guy you'll meet.
Yeah. He's totally just like a film nerd, right? And you hear him talking, he talks like this, and he talks really quickly, and he's blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Right? He's kind of like, so, but yeah, you're right, though. Yeah, at the same token, yeah, I love his movies, though. Like, you know, so the only thing I don't know how it is for you, but like, now some of the movies are just a little too much of the, you know, he's so like violence against women and some of the stuff doesn't age very well, right? Like the so much like N-bombs and, you know, the language. I know he's trying to be real and edgy and so forth, but like at a certain point, I think he could have probably dialed that in and it wouldn't have affected his storytelling or his movies at all. In fact, it probably would have enhanced them because, you know, you just tame it down. The 90s, I get, because it's like, you know, the Wild West. There was so much in the 90s about shock jocks and, you know, shock TV and stuff like that. And, you know, he's trying to make a name for himself and I get it. And it works for Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs and such. But the further on he got, I honestly don't think he needed to be super like that far into like the, you know, the hyper violence and the racism and all that kind of stuff. That's just sort of me. I found it to be a little bit off towards his last couple movies. Don't know how you felt about it.
Well, I felt like his movies, like, because like as artists, you're supposed to improve. And I felt like Django is really good. Like, I didn't feel like it was racist because like he was showing that kind of side of the story. Like, he shifted the narrative there. But like, he is one of those people who are able to get away with virtually anything and like not a lot. And he's associated with Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein was the person who he was a producer at Miramax. And
right, yeah, like the whole Me Too thing, right?
Yeah, he actually said that on that same podcast with Joe Rogan. He's like, Harvey Weinstein was like kind of like a fucked up father figure to him.
Yeah, that's right. And he kind of acknowledged the fact that he knew this stuff was going on, but he didn't really have it in his power, I guess, or however he worded it, to be able to kind of step in, and he feels bad about it, right? So
and I think that probably was the case. Like, a lot of people, I think like everyone in Hollywood knew what was going on, but like that was just like the norm. Like, you couldn't say anything about it. Apparently Brad Pitt, when he was dating was it Gwyneth Paltrow, apparently, oh no, I think it was with Jennifer Aniston.
Okay.
But Harvey Weinstein tried to hit on them, and Brad Pitt was dating her at the time. So he actually went up and confronted Harvey Weinstein about it, and no one else actually did it. Like, he was going to beat him up and things.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool. I did not know that. I could totally see Brad Pitt being like that. He seems like a pretty cool, pretty real dude in real life. I don't know. He seems like he's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know this guy. He's a cameraman, and he said like he knows someone who actually worked with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. Like, he was driving them. Yeah, and apparently like Angelina Jolie, like the whole time she was just like screaming at this driver and things. And
really,
yeah, and Brad Pitt was just there smoking weed the whole time on the trip.
I guess what else do you do, right? that's crazy. Yeah. That's a funny story.
But like, I also heard like stories like that. They're saying like Brad Pitt was aggro, like he's starting fights at clubs and things. So
really?
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting. I didn't know about that. I guess you had the fight club thing, right?
Yeah. He probably had some of that Tyler Durden in him.
Tyler Durden. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Tyler Durden is a little close to home for him there, the character.
Yeah. And he also did that 12 Monkeys, that character over there. That was kind of... He was like a kind of an insane person.
Yeah. Yeah. In the insane asylum there. That was a pretty cool movie. I haven't watched that in a while, actually. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like just that kind of stuff, like behind the scenes, it's quite interesting when you look at it. Like all these people, like they are like quite, they like a different kind of characters when you like actually look at them from the outside.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's what I was talking about earlier too. I love the behind the scenes stuff, yeah. Especially when it's like, it seems like it was a trouble, like it was a troubling time to get through the filming of something. And then yet the movie is just excellent. So you can tell the tension on set probably contributed to the performances and so forth. Like, I love hearing about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Like when you just like look at like, just like the care, like we were talking about Angelina Jolie and like how she was like reacting and stuff. And then you look at like Billy Bob Thornton, their relationship is just like weird, they're like playing it off. Yeah, they're playing it off the screen. And apparently, like Billy Bob Thornton, he has, I should probably fact check this, but I heard like he has a phobia of like antique furniture, which I just found crazy.
That's so like seemingly so specific. Like, why would I wonder what would have brought that phobia on. Like, did you like a haunted couch at some point or something? Like,
or maybe like he lived in a museum and like his mother used to beat him with like old furniture or something.
Right. Yeah. There you go. Exactly. There has to be something that set that off. Or, I mean, Billy Bob Thornton's a weird enough guy that he would just say it, put that out there just so, you know, you and I are talking about it now. Right. It's like, oh, you know, we'll see who actually believes this. Right.
Yo, that'd be kind of insane.
Yeah. Right. So random. He's a different cat too, man. Like I think he kind of topped out with like that movie Sling Blade, where he's kind of doing like the whole, I am to kill you with it. He's kind of doing like that.
Oh shit. That's a pretty good impersonation there. Right?
Yeah. You know which one I'm talking about. Obviously. Yeah.
I haven't watched that movie, but like you're nailing his voice.
Yeah. Right. It's definitely worth watching, dude. It's I want to say, man, who did the music? I want to say Billy Bob Thornton's band.
I heard he does have a band, like he was a musician. I haven't actually heard his stuff.
No, but I have. Like, I mean, aside from the soundtrack for that movie, which was like so good, like it really added an element to that movie. So aside from that, I haven't heard his music though.
Oh, yeah. I just found that. I Googled it. It says Billy Bob Thornton hates antiques so much he refuses to stay in a room with furniture from before 1950.
That's like his cutoff. He's like, well, this is 51. Okay, I'll stay here then. Like, how would he know?
Yeah, like maybe like Google's is like, no, that's too old. Yeah.
That's too old. I'm out of here. That's comedy, man. That's like one of the funniest things I've heard in a while.
Yeah. I think it was Bill Burr. He was saying that like, he realized what true comedy was when he was walking home and he saw like two people fighting, and like they looked like they didn't want to fight each other, and everyone around them were like obviously pushing them on to carry on fighting, so they had to fight. And he just realized like that's true comedy, because comedy is like bad, like for the people who are in the fight, it's not funny at all. But if you're looking at it from the outside, it's hilarious.
That's a cool insight, actually. Nice. That's pretty. That's what Billy Bob Thornton said that?
No. Bill Burr. I don't know if you know him. He's a comedian.
No, I'm not super familiar, no. That's a cool quote, though. That's a good perspective. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and if you look at, like, the Joker movie, that's exactly his point of view as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of a good point, right? I mean, there's so many. I mean, look at that movie, like the guys from Jackass. I guess it was funny to them too, but you get what I mean. They're hurting themselves, kicking themselves in the nuts.
That's messed up.
It's so messed up. And there we go. We're talking, you know, like that's from the 90s too. It seems like the 90s was.
I heard they're doing a reunion.
Yeah, dude. Isn't that, it's kind of sad though, because they're like 50. They're like over 50. Like, why are you guys doing this? I mean, yeah, I know
they could kill themselves.
Right? Money? At least before when they're in their 30s, you're still a little bit like, you know, in pretty good physical shape or whatever. But I mean, maybe they still are, but you're still 50, right? Like at the end
of the day. Like a boxer. Like if you see Evander Holyfield, like he went to fight again at age 58. And
yeah, what was up with that, dude? That's sad.
Yeah, apparently he wasn't even supposed to fight that week. Oscar De La Hoya was supposed to fight Victor Belfort. But De La Hoya had COVID, and De La Hoya was a welterweight. And so he's going to be fighting at light heavy. I think he would have definitely have been injured. Like COVID literally saved his life.
Right. Well, and then De La Hoya is going to be up there too, right? Maybe not 58, but he's got to be in his late 40s, early 50s, is he?
Yeah. And he had a coke problem. Like, he was addicted to cocaine and things. Like, he had
Yeah.
So he's probably not as fit as you'd hope to be.
Well, yeah, especially, man, like, think of your cardio, like, your heart is probably all enlarged, and, well, I mean, who knows, right? But you know what I mean? Like, his cardio couldn't be there if he's I mean, it depends on how long ago he was doing coke, I suppose.
But yeah, you know what I mean? He said his plan was to come back, do, like, two fights that are, like, not too high level, and then he wanted to either fight Canelo Alvarez or Floyd Mayweather. And that's crazy. Like, he and Canelo have beef because Canelo was under his promotion, but then they had a falling out. But Canelo, he's on another level right now.
Right. Yeah. And then even like Mayweather, it's a money fight at that point, right? It's just, it's two names almost from the past. Like, Mayweather's closer to being a recent name, obviously, than De La Hoya, but still, I mean, that's what Mayweather does now almost. He does these like almost kind of gimmicky, like not theatrical, but just the side of theatrical, like the whole McGregor fight, right? It was kind of a, you know, almost theater in a way, right?
And then he fought Logan Paul.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. What was up with that? I never ended up watching like any highlights of that. How did that go?
Well, Logan Paul gave him a good fight, but Logan Paul's obviously bigger. He's like middleweight or something. I saw Mayweather, he changed his stance, but like he couldn't touch Mayweather, and Mayweather, he's a genius at doing what he does. So
yeah,
but they weren't allowed to like actually call out a winner, so it was just an exhibition with like
I get you. Yeah,
that's the thing. Logan Paul did well in the first two rounds. I'd give him like I'd say he won the first two rounds, but Mayweather was just
Wow, that's that's something.
But I think Mayweather also allowed him.
Oh, that's the thing, right? Because like Mayweather definitely allowed McGregor some leeway, big time. You know, right? So, and that's Mayweather's style is like he's all about like he'll let the other guy kind of punch himself out almost, right? He's just gonna keep moving. You know, he's more of a defensive fighter, right? So,
yeah, like Mayweather able to adapt in a fight, and that's like amazing.
Totally. One thing I really enjoyed though about like the Mayweather McGregor stuff was all the hype beforehand. Like,
yeah, that fight was crazy. So the hype. So both of them are so good at promoting themselves.
Oh, so good. I like it because initially Mayweather wasn't really, he was just kind of, you know, sitting there with his hat on, and McGregor was just eating him up, right? So then that the Mayweather character kind of came out, and then he was wearing a cape and all that, and then all of a sudden it's a little more entertaining. But at first, man, McGregor was just like destroying him, like the whole thing's like, you've got a backpack, you can't even read,
right? Yeah.
That was funny, man.
Yeah, like Mayweather, I mean, McGregor, he's actually the richest athlete on Forbes right now. And he only fought once this year. And the last time won a fight, he only won one fight since Barack Obama was president.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow. Yeah. That's a crazy stat, actually. Wow.
And imagine, like, he's richer than Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi, Mayweather. But that's crazy. It's because of his whiskey, his brand, because he was able to create a brand, the Proper 12. And I think he sold the rights to it or something, which actually was why but that means he's never going to be on that listed or number one again on Forbes, but.
Sure.
Yeah, but he accomplished something that's never been done.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, there's got to be something to be said for that. He's so entertaining and pretty cool. Like when you see the rise of him, like before he was all tatted up and before he had like the beard, he just looked like some dude, right?
Yeah, he was a plumber on welfare.
crazy, man. So you can never take that away from him. And as far as like trash talking, I like when he'd always grab his opponent's belt, like from them, and then like hold it up. You know, I love that stuff, man. He's so good at the trash talking. And then he's always respectful after, right? Well, for the most part, except for the last fight there where he's calling out the guy's wife or whatever. But he's usually pretty, you know, he's usually pretty respectful after.
The one person he won't be respectful to is Khabib. He literally, every time you mention his name, like his face changes, his whole posture shifts. Like he actually tweeted something. I think he was drunk when he tweeted it. He's like, because Khabib was like, after Dustin Poirier won the fight, Khabib was like, this is a perfect example of good defeating evil. So McGregor responded by saying, because Khabib's father passed away from COVID. So he's like, COVID good, Khabib dad bad.
No! Oh, that's rough, man. But yeah. It's right there. So I could totally see him saying that. But that's rough. That's so rough. It's one thing to insult the guy, but like when you start bringing in like, you know, family.
Especially that's like his father. Like he has like, his father's a very respected person than Dougie Stein. Right. And Khabib, like, and he just passed away.
Ah, man. Yeah, I see that's too far. I mean, there's like talking shit before the fight and all that, but that is, that's not overly cool.
I think like McGregor's ego is like plays a large factor in him, because even recently, I don't know if you heard it, he and Machine Gun Kelly, they were at the VMAs, and apparently McGregor wanted a photo with MGK, and MGK shrugged him off. But that's not actually what happened. So both of their PR teams like rushed to get the story out first, and MGK's team got it out and they released that narrative. But what they're saying really happened was because Machine Gun Kelly's dating Megan Fox. Megan Fox is a fan of Conor McGregor's. She goes to his shows and stuff. So he wanted to like get a picture with her, and MGK was with them, and he's like, no, you can't. And so McGregor got pissed off about that. And I think he threw a water bottle at him or something.
I'm serious?
and he's there with his walking stick, but he's like, he's gone like buffer than he was before. He's like,
really?
Yeah, he's looking like a beast now.
Man. Well, I said he's doing all the workout, like upper body workout while his leg moves, right? So
yeah.
He's just like a lightning rod though, right? And there's not too many of those guys around anymore, like guys or girls that are like, you, as soon as they're on the screen, like you just have to pay attention to what they say. And it's must see TV because you don't know what they're going to do, right? So he definitely fills that that void that's kind of been missing, because everybody's, you know, pretty, for the most part, pretty polite and politically correct, right? Because they don't want to have the whole cancel culture and all the other things that might happen. And McGregor just doesn't care one way or the other, right?
Yeah, and like he's kind of allowed to get away with it because that's what like made him what he is now. And
well, exactly,
he's been doing it for so long, that's like his personality.
Yeah, right. It's that's the thing. I wonder if there's any pressure on him, like from his own camp, from himself, to keep that up, right? Because like there's almost an expectation he's going to do something like throw a water bottle at somebody, you know. It's like man, there's got to be some degree of pressure to like one up yourself every time. I wonder if that's like, that's got to be a bit negative, mindset definitely for him sometimes, right?
I don't know if you saw him if you saw him during the second Dustin Poirier fight.
No.
Yeah, that fight, he was like very humble. Like he was like, they're like doing it for charity. Like he was like endorsing Dustin Poirier's barbecue sauce. And like he donated money to his charity. Like he was like very polite and things. And then after he lost that fight, he was like still respectful. And then a few months later, like he started like getting like very nasty and like the stuff you're saying. And then during the fight, the press conference, he's like just like super disrespectful and things.
Yeah, so it's weird, eh? Because you can see it. Obviously, he has that side to him that he can be respectful and so forth. But so it's just, I wonder if it is, if there's just like this pressure to always be, the brash, the controversial side, right? especially when he's throwing, he's probably freaking half tuned all the time when he's up there. He's had a couple shots of whiskey before he's up there, right? Guaranteed.
Yeah, especially with the Khabib, like he was actually like trying to give Khabib
Yeah. And he's, oh man, that was hard to watch, but it was so like entertaining though, right?
Yeah, the numbers, like with sales, like he's dead, like UFC makes a whole lot of more money when Conor McGregor's doing shit like that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, exactly. That's why, what's his nuts there? He's always
Dana White about it.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks. Yeah, Dana White is always chuckling for the most part, right? Because every time he does that, he's like, oh, there you go. That's money for us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy, man.
Yeah, it is for sure. That's cool. I like we kind of went into a whole, I mean, we kind of were starting talking about pop culture and we just sort of like went down a bunch of different roads talking, you know, professional athletes, talking filmmaking. I like it.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's what it's about, man. Like if you talk about pop culture, that's where it leads. Like it's everywhere. Yeah, the influence is everywhere. Like in all mediums of entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, no, and it's interesting because now, I mean, you and I have been talking about different eras, right? So you kind of think, okay, McGregor seems like he's the kind of guy that could have, he would have fit in nicely in really any era, right? Like the 90s, he would have still been top of the food chain, you know, now just the way he is. Just the
Irish warrior, like he'd probably be like, he'd be an Irish warrior, like back in Celtic times.
Exactly, right? There's just certain people that you can tell, like regardless of where they would have been in the, you know, the time period of humanity, they would have been they were
like, it's kind of crazy themselves. Like there's certain individuals, no matter what time or place you put them in, they're able to rise above everyone else. Like Jay-Z actually mentioned that in one of his songs. He's like, put me in any situation or put me anywhere in the world, I'll still rise up. And like the way he, like he's a billionaire now, like he's having dinners with like politicians and things.
Yeah, crazy.
And he was someone who used to like sell crack once upon a time.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of those stories, especially in like rap and hip hop. It seems like, hey, these guys that are, and that's why, you know, dude, I think there's like a correlation between why they can be these monster entrepreneurs is because they essentially were entrepreneurs when they were selling crack and weed and all that, right? They kind of have that nature to them already, like Dr. Dre, right? Dude, when he sells beats to Apple or whatever it was for, what was it? Something like 500 million or something like that? Like crazy.
Yeah, like I think like to be able to be a businessman, like you need to have that killer instinct that comes from like the streets and stuff. Cause it's the same, like you have to play your opponent. That's why like gangsters are the best businessmen. If you think about it, like if you look at videos on YouTube where they try to like break down the personality traits of a good entrepreneur, they often refer to like pop culture and mafia characters. Like you look at Scarface or Tommy, Thomas Shelby from Peaky Blinders. I don't know if you've seen that, but like,
I haven't.
Yeah, that's a really good show. And like, they're like, his character is like so on the nose or like on what a person who like wants to succeed during those times or in London. But like, so you could see like a businessman being similar to that.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting way of looking at it, actually. It totally makes sense though, right? When you think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. No, super cool.
Hey, man. It was great having you on the show.
Yeah, dude. Thanks so much for having me on. Like, you got a really good show here. I like your format. You know, we got a chance to promote the album at the beginning, and then we just, you know, just kind of have a conversation about art and pop culture, and it kind of goes some different spots. So really cool format to your show, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely, man. It was great having you on the show. It was interesting hearing your point of view on certain subjects and things. And it's always nice speaking to people and like hearing how they look at, because everyone has like their own opinions and own perspective on things. And it's nice finding out what that is.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. I always like talking about it. I like talking to, you know, other musicians and artists as well. And you know, like I say, I liked your, you know, Enter the Muse. Like it just, it drew me in. So you got a really good show here. I'll definitely continue to listen and continue to follow you. And yeah, let's, we'll definitely stay in touch. I'll send out an invite to you and you should come on my, I got a podcast as well. I'd love to have you on.
Oh, cool. How long have you had this podcast for?
So the format I've been doing recently, I just started in April, but honestly, I've been doing podcasting for probably about 6 or 7 years now. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, dude. So, I will, I'll definitely reach out to you and I would love to have you on and you can, promote some of your music or even just your podcast and we can kind of, continue the conversation.
Awesome, man. Appreciate it. Take care. Hey?
Yeah, man. Thanks, Nick. Have a good day.
Awesome. You too. Cheers.
Take care. Bye-bye.